The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
We all have stories about stuff we want to buy but can't find. Patio furniture, a bicycle, our favorite peach-flavored drink. We're scratching our heads and wondering, where's my stuff? Global supply chains are pushed to the limit.
Well, it's your fault. It's my fault. It's all of our fault. We didn't go anywhere for 15 months, and people substituted experiences for stuff.
Also today, it's now possible for Americans to go to Europe. Just do your homework before departure.
When I was at the airport at Logan in Boston, I saw lots of people in tears, crying, being denied boarding.
And here in the U.S., states are offering cash prizes to get vaccinated. In Thailand, they're dangling free cows. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being with us. An election in Iran last Friday, and today the newly elected president held his first press conference in Tehran. Ibrahim Raisi takes over from Hassan Rouhani at a challenging time for Iran, domestically and internationally. One big question, how to engage or not with the U.S. Raisi made his position clear today. Will he meet President Biden? No. But Raisi also said negotiations over Iran's nuclear program must continue. Joining me now is The World's Shirin Jafari. It is a big question, what will happen with the Iran nuclear deal, Shirin, now that Ibrahim Raisi is about to take over the presidency. Let's not get ahead of ourselves, though. How did President-elect Raisi do in his first press conference? What are the big headlines?
Marco, Raisi seemed a bit nervous at first when he started out the conference, but later he seemed a bit more relaxed. He sat behind a desk that was covered by a sea of colorful microphones, and most of them belong to news organizations that are allowed to operate in Iran. As you know, there are a lot of restrictions for press in Iran. But as for what he said, he repeated some of the statements that he has said before during his campaign, that his top priority is going to be getting the economy back on its feet, and that he sees himself as somebody who has the best interest of Iranian people in his mind. But one of the highlights of the press conference was when an Al Jazeera reporter asked Raisi about his responsibility in the mass execution that took place in Iran in the 1980s. Raisi was part of a team that was called the Death Commission. He oversaw the execution of thousands of political prisoners. He's saying, I've always been a defender of human rights. I've always regarded human rights as an important issue in any position that I've held in the past. So not exactly a revealing answer, Marco, but the fact that he was even asked this question in his first press conference seemed significant.
Yeah, really. So Raisi won about 18 million votes, according to Iran's interior ministry. That's out of 29 million total. Where does that stand in comparison to past elections? And in other words, how popular is Raisi in Iran?
Last week's election in Iran had the lowest turnout in the history of the Islamic Republic. Turnout was about 48%, according to official figures. A lot of people decided to boycott and stay home. Also, some 3.7 million people either accidentally or intentionally voided their ballots, meaning that they cast a ballot for somebody that was not running or they made a mistake on the ballot. It could also be seen as a way to protest this election. So not a lot of excitement in this election this year.
So, Shirin, all of this is going on while negotiations about Iran's nuclear program have been taking place in Vienna. How has the election in Iran impacted those negotiations?
Well, yesterday, the head of the Iran negotiating team, Abbas Araghchi, said that the sides are closer to a deal now more than ever before. But he said that they have decided to take a break.
The remaining job is still difficult and needs lots of, you know, efforts and further talks. So we decided to cut negotiations here, go back home.
He said, Marco, that this pause in the negotiations is that so that they can go back home and consult leaders in Iran. As for how the election is going to impact negotiations, President-elect Ibrahim Raisi doesn't take office until August. So there is a chance that a deal can be reached before then. Raisi has said that he's in fact in favor of continuing these negotiations because at the end of the day, what is important is that these sanctions that the U.S. has imposed on Iran get lifted because they have really severely hampered Iran's economy, and that's a huge problem right now in Iran.
The world's Shirin Jafari with the latest on the Iranian presidential election and what the results might mean for the future of the Iran nuclear deal. Shirin, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
For more than a year now, 458 days to be exact, American travelers have been on an EU blacklist of sorts, prohibited from visiting Europe for non-essential reasons. Now the ban is being lifted. Seems like great news for people hoping to make it across the pond this summer. But is it? The World's Lydia Manalidou is on the line from Athens to break this down. So what exactly is changing, Lydia, with travel?
Yeah, so as you said, Marco, for more than a year now, people from the U.S. were, for the most part, not allowed to travel to the EU for non-essential reasons like tourism. But now what's changing is that EU officials are going to member states and saying it's time to start reopening. Now, people in the U.S. who are hearing this who want to travel to Europe shouldn't rush to pack their suitcases and go off because it's not like the doors of Europe are wide open and Europeans are waiting with open arms. It's now going to be up to each country to decide when and how they want to start lifting the restrictions that have been in place for U.S. travel. They could require that people be fully vaccinated, that people quarantine when they arrive in the country. We'll have to wait and see how different EU countries decide to move forward in the next few weeks.
In some EU countries, like Greece, where you are, Lydia, American tourists were already allowed, right?
Right. Several EU countries have kind of gone rogue over the last few weeks and months and reopened. You know, we're talking about countries that really rely heavily on tourism, countries like Greece, Spain, Croatia, and others. And so, you know, as much as the EU has tried to come up with this coordinated and uniform tourism reopening plan, that's not actually what's been happening. So what we have now is this sort of mishmash of policies and rules that travelers have to navigate. So I'm actually hosting a tourist from the U.S. right now, my friend and our former colleague Diego Lopez. He's fully vaccinated and he traveled from Boston just a couple of days ago. And I asked him if he had any advice for U.S. travelers.
Definitely you have to do your homework before you go. When I was at the airport at Logan in Boston, I saw lots of people in tears, crying, being denied boarding.
So Lydia, what had those despairing passengers been upset about? What did they not do right?
So different countries have different requirements. There are documents you're supposed to submit. Also, COVID-19 tests. People traveling to countries that don't require COVID-19 tests were really surprised to find out that airlines require them. And because they didn't have them, they could not board a plane. And it's not just the rules of the country you're traveling to or the rules of the airline you have to pay attention to, but you also have to be mindful of the rules of the countries you are traveling through to get somewhere.
So this is all happening as well as the new Delta variant, first identified in India, is becoming an increasing concern for health officials everywhere, but especially in Europe. What are they saying right now?
Yeah, this is definitely a concern for officials, and it's something that the WHO Europe director, Dr. Hans Klug, brought up at a recent press conference.
The new Delta variant of concern, which shows increased transmissibility and some immune escape, is poised to take hold in the region.
And we're already seeing that happen in some countries like Portugal, where they're experiencing the biggest spike in COVID cases since February. And authorities there have said that it is the new Delta variant that's really driving that spike. So over the weekend, over this past weekend, they reintroduced some travel restrictions. So people were no longer allowed to travel in and out of Lisbon. And this shows you things are quite unpredictable right now. New restrictions might come up. And this is also a reminder that people should travel cautiously when they do.
The world's Lydia Manalidou in Athens. Thanks for explaining this.
Thank you, Marco.
Here are two striking numbers. In China, roughly 8 million people are blind. Out of all of them, only 11 took China's college entrance exams this year. 11 out of 8 million. Most blind people in China find jobs that use other senses, massage therapists or piano tuners, for example. One man in China wanted more. He recently became the first blind person in Asia to climb Mount Everest. From Shanghai, the world's Rebecca Canther has our story.
Zhang Hong grew up in the rural countryside, caring for his dad and uncle, who were blind from glaucoma. At age 21, he lost his sight too. A few years ago, he heard about Eric Weinmayer, the first blind person to summit Everest 20 years ago. And Zhang Hong was inspired to attempt it himself. He spent years training his body to prepare for the climb. Every day, he'd strap on a heavy bag and climb 100 flights of stairs at the hospital where he and his wife work as massage therapists. But it couldn't fully prepare him for the challenge of climbing Everest during a pandemic at the age of 46. Once they started the ascent, Zhang Hong says the biggest challenge was the weather. It was very dangerous, he says. The weather was very bad. My guide kept telling me, soon, soon. But all I felt was fear. Part of me wanted to give up and part of me wanted to keep going. His guide, Chang Zi, talked him through the entire final ascent, which took them more than 13 hours in low oxygen conditions. I didn't know where my next step will be, and I didn't know the ice condition, Zhang Hong says. I didn't know where to put my feet, how to stay balanced. I had to depend on my guide's directions every step of the way. It was very hard. But he says, climbing blind has one advantage. You can't see the danger around you. My guide kept telling me it would just be another half an hour, another half an hour. But it seemed to be so long, he says. I thought he was lying to me. Then he told me it was just the last bit of rope. Even when he told me there's the summit up ahead, I didn't really believe him, he says. Then my guide told me, you made it to the summit, Zhang Hong says. I only believed him after he said it a few times. Most climbers describe reaching the summit by what they can see, the curve of the earth, the mountain peaks, the wispy clouds below them. Zhang Hong says that for him, that moment was totally different. A video captured him standing among the Tibetan prayer flags at the peak. The wind was beating my head, he says. It was like a monster. I was absolutely terrified. There was none of the excitement I expected to feel. All I could feel was the wide open space and the sound of the wind. It was so stressful.
Zhang Hong, congratulations, congratulations.
Over a walkie-talkie, he and his team shared congratulations with a film crew who has been following him. I told my guide, let's take a photo and quickly go down, he says. I was only at the top about 5 minutes. But he says, reaching the peak was never the goal. When you reach the top of Everest, you're only halfway there, he says. It's not on the way up where most mountain climbers get into trouble. It's on the way back down. So I knew I hadn't succeeded yet. He says that sense of accomplishment only came days later when he made it off the mountain. Climbing Mount Everest wasn't just about testing his physical strength. It was also about facing up to his own fears, Zhang says. It was an impossible dream, says Fan Lixin, who led the documentary team on the climb.
I thought if I would be able to follow the process, the story can reflect something larger than life, and it's a story that would affect all of us. We all need the same kind of courage to face the Mount Everest in every one of our lives.
Even after facing his own Everest, Zhang Hong says he's only just begun. He hopes to complete an explorer's grand slam, reaching the 7 tallest peaks in the world, along with the North and South Poles. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In Brazil this weekend, mass protests against the government's handling of the pandemic. Many Brazilians blame President Jair Bolsonaro for not purchasing vaccines earlier and for fighting mask protocols and social restrictions. COVID infections again appear to be on the rise in Brazil as the nation hit another grim milestone today, a 500,000 recorded deaths from COVID-19. A video from Rio that's gone viral on social media captures the moment. Crowds of activists stand with their fists raised and their faces covered by masks. Today we hear from Brazilians from across the country about what this moment means for them.
I live in the south of Brazil, in a town called Caxias do Sul. I've just lost one of my best friends today to the disease. It's so sad because it's one of the 500,000 that died to a disease that has a vaccine already. We could save more people.
I would dare to say I have never been prepared to witness day after day the number of deaths we are facing daily here in Brazil, as COVID-19 is dragging this whole country into a sanitary war.
We don't study to be a doctor to see people die. We choose to be a doctor to see people live. Unfortunately, this disease has showed us how powerless we are and has prevented people, members of a family, to say the last goodbye.
The moment that actually was like repulsing for me was when our president said, I think we have reached like 200,000 deaths by the time. And he says like, whatever. As like, lives don't matter, people don't matter. You know, I think that's like, was like the bottom of this whole thing, because like showed like how much like our government don't care about life.
We are on the front line of the worst numbers and worst situation in the world. My hope is that we improve our vaccination in Brazil, and that we don't have another wave like we had in last March. That was the worst for us.
That was Gustavo Pinto. You also heard from Hujimar, Conceição, Henun Rocha, Renata Rivera, and Isaac Schwartzhaupt, each reflecting on the milestone of 500,000 deaths from COVID-19 in Brazil. The man accused of killing a family in London, Ontario, because they were Muslim, appeared in court today. Nathaniel Veltman has been charged with 4 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of attempted murder. For the first time in Canada, prosecutors say they also plan to charge him with terrorism for an alleged act of Islamophobia. Anita Elash reports from Toronto.
The Afzal family was out for an evening stroll 2 weeks ago when police say a man deliberately rammed into them with his truck. 4 members of the family died and a 9-year-old boy was injured. When prosecutors announced they would charge Nathaniel Veltman with terrorism, Canadian Muslims welcomed the news. Nawaz Tahir is a spokesperson for the London Mosque.
It says to the Muslim community, we value the Muslim community and we will push for accountability.
Terrorism has been a criminal offense in Canada since the 9/11 attacks on the United States. The law has been used almost exclusively to prosecute people with ties to radical Islamist groups. And Tahir says that's left many Muslims feeling frustrated.
The frustration is, well, when Canadian Muslims are being killed and it appears to be an act of terror, why haven't terrorism charges been used?
Tahir points to a shooting rampage at the Quebec City Mosque in 2017. 6 people died and 5 were injured. The shooter, Alexandre Bissonnette, was sentenced to 40 years for murder, the longest sentence in Canadian history. But he was never charged with terrorism.
There was a lot of anger about whether the justice system was serious about protecting Muslims.
Like most democracies, Canada defines terrorism as the use of violence that's meant to coerce or scare people. But prosecutors also have to prove that an alleged terrorist act was motivated by religion, politics, or ideology. Terrorism expert Wesley Wark says unless there's clear evidence, like a confession or a written manifesto,
the chances of you being able to prove definitively, in a court of law setting, that kind of motivation may be slim.
Adding a terrorism charge to an existing murder charge doesn't increase the sentence. So Wark says it's a safer bet to stick with simple murder.
Because the implications of losing such a case, if you lay terrorism charges and other criminal code charges, is really devastating. It's devastating to relations of the victims. It's devastating to the government's efforts to counter terrorism in all kinds of obvious ways. It's an embarrassment.
But Leah West, an expert in national security law, says the balance between getting a guaranteed conviction and sending a message about terrorism has started to shift.
There is a sense that the public interest does weigh in favor of actually denouncing the act of violence as terrorism, not just to denounce this type of activity for those who might seek to engage or who have similar belief systems, but also to signal to the communities that they have been the targets of terrorism, and what they are suffering from is victimization by a terrorist group or a terrorist.
West says that reflects a change in the type of terrorist activity on security officials' radar, which previously focused on Islamist-inspired extremism.
Individuals can be motivated to take terrorist acts by all kinds of ideologies and belief systems, and we're seeing those increasingly target various communities within Canada.
In a report released last year, Canada's Security Intelligence Service said there'd been a sharp increase in ideologically motivated extremism. It said the threat posed by xenophobic, misogynist, and anti-government groups and ideologies is greater than ever. Police in Ontario still haven't said what evidence they have that the attack on the Afzal family was ideologically motivated. But Nawaz Tahir says Muslims in the community are shaken to the core.
Some people have asked, should I go for a walk if I'm wearing traditional clothing? Some women have asked, should I now take off my hijab?
He says a successful prosecution for terrorism, as well as for murder, could be the start of their healing. For The World, I'm Anita Elash in Toronto.
About a month out from the Tokyo Olympics, and organizers said today that local fans will be allowed to attend events, despite warnings from health officials. Read about it in our daily newsletter. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. You're listening to The World. Behind the Beach Boys was legendary music producer Van Dyke Parks. To work with him was a dream for Mexican musician Veronica Valerio, a dream until he returned her call.
I told Van Dyke, my knees are shaking. Is it you? Is it you? And he's like, come on, come on.
That's coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The other day I went shopping for the kibble I feed my dog, out of stock, and the store did not know when they'd get more. These days, a lot of us are wondering, where's my stuff? What's taking so long? We asked The World's Jason Margolis to look into this.
Last summer, the caster wheel on my outdoor ping pong table broke, so I ordered a new one. Pretty straightforward.
Did you eventually get the caster you were looking for?
Oh, yeah. I invited my friend John Mulliken over to come play and talk through what happened. He knows a lot about moving stuff around the world, getting things from here to there. He used to be the chief technology officer at Wayfair.
The biggest online furniture retailer in the world.
All right, so here we are in my backyard. We just played ping pong. You're an excellent ping pong player. That wheel took me 6 months to get. I ordered it in June.
6 months is a really long time.
Does that surprise you?
Not at all. Everything was taking forever.
So given your expertise, why are you not surprised by this?
Well, it's your fault. It's my fault. It's all of our fault. I mean, we didn't go anywhere for 15 months, and people substituted experiences for stuff. They just started buying stuff, and more stuff. And there's only so many factories in the world, and there's only so many boats and planes in the world.
To get a little more technical, my ping pong wheel didn't arrive from Asia because global supply chains are out of whack, sometimes with devastating impacts, says Thomas Romer. He co-directs MIT's LGO program, or Leaders for Global Operations.
I hear from manufacturers of sophisticated goods, like ventilators, we were waiting for people that could deliver the right bolts. We're talking bolts. We're talking about something that is actually fairly easy to manufacture.
Academics like Romer study this phenomenon where sudden changes in demand can create big production challenges up and down the supply chain. At MIT, they run an academic exercise using beer.
Hypothetical beer. So you have a retailer, then you have a wholesaler. Now the retailer gives the demand, needs to estimate demand for the wholesaler has a distributor, and behind that there's a factory or a brewery. And it's a lot more fun to play with beer than with matches or something like that. At least with hypothetical beer.
When playing the beer game, you can see what happens when everybody suddenly wants to try your new brew. Suppliers struggle to react quickly enough. That's just an academic simulation taught in business schools, though. With the pandemic,
it's like a conductor basically saying, now we all play the beer game with 20,000 different products, not just with beer.
And things got a bit crazy. Everybody wanted hand sanitizer, toilet paper, individual ketchup packets, and bicycles like yesterday. Factories and businesses simply couldn't keep up. Then add this in, modern businesses have gotten really good at running lean. Holding excess inventory is expensive. Warehousing costs add up. After World War II, Toyota pioneered what's called just-in-time delivery. Inventory is created as needed. Toyota's model, avoid waste, stay nimble, save money. Willie Shi at the Harvard Business School says his students know these lessons well.
I look at students in the school and they're all allergic to carrying inventory, right? Because it all can be turned into cash.
For decades, our global supply chain system has mostly worked really well. But for things to go smoothly, businesses need to accurately forecast demand and have a reliable delivery system. Throw a big wrench in the system like a deadly global virus.
All those assumptions about easy movement of goods, reliability, dependability, low cost, those have all gone out the window. If you look at ocean container shipping, reliability and schedule reliability is at an all-time low.
So it's fairly simple economics, actually.
Mirto Kalopsidi is an economist specializing in trade and transport markets on the other side of Harvard's campus. She says it's about supply and demand with ships, too. Factories in Asia haven't been able to get access to sea transport. Then at U.S. ports, container ships have been backed up. That's partly because fewer dock workers were available during the pandemic. And now, a fresh wave of COVID infections at some Asian ports is causing further disruptions.
So you're going to have a lot of people looking for ships. Prices are going to spike, and there won't be enough ships to transport this.
Still, economists and business leaders say you don't blow up the system because of one wild year. So getting back to my ping pong wheel.
Is this flat?
Let's put things in a bit of perspective. Is it really that big of a deal if my wheel was delayed by a few months? I asked my friend John Mulliken if I'm just being a little whiny.
Well, for a ping pong table, yeah, I mean, I think you are kind of whiny. You could have used a book. But for many pieces, like, you know, vital equipment to make equipment in hospitals do what they're supposed to do, they had the exact same problems. And that's not just being whiny. I mean, the reality is that we're used to behaving in a certain way. The whole economy has been spending decades trying to get leaner and leaner. And so that's all fine as long as everything goes exactly as predicted. And the reality is once there's a hiccup in the system, you're stuck.
So in answer to the question, where's my stuff? It's coming, but expect further delays. For the world, I'm Jason Margolis.
Can do 11?
Sure.
You don't want to have any disadvantages? You don't have any excuses?
In Ethiopia today, an election for a new parliament. Not just any election. This marks the first multi-party election in 16 years in what is Africa's second most populous country. On the other hand, many are calling the elections political theater. After all, the government has jailed many opposition leaders, and voting has been canceled in volatile areas like the country's northern, war-torn Tigray region. Tigray has been smoldering since early November when Ethiopia's government went in with a violent campaign to disarm its political rivals. So while voting is happening in much of Ethiopia, starvation looms in Tigray. Joining me now on the line is journalist Sedele Lema. She's a founder of The Addis Standard, a monthly magazine based in Ethiopia. Sedele, who is voting in today's elections and who's on the sidelines?
This election is not involving the major parties that do not agree with the prime minister's ideology of how he wanted to shape the state after the election. So they have been at the receiving end of repeated crackdown, jailing, killing, arresting, disappearing, forcefully disappearing members, even the big ones like Jawar Mohammed. And so these parties withdrew from the election. So will that give him a legitimacy? No. Tigray has completely been kept outside because it's a war zone, and the prime minister refused international calls to end the war and start a political settlement.
Sedele, help us understand something. Prime Minister Ahmed came to power in Ethiopia in 2018 with so much promise and enthusiasm. He clinched the Nobel Peace Prize for seeming to embrace his rivals. So help us understand what happened.
The Nobel Peace Prize is, I think, it's one of the greatest theatrics that the world has fallen for. We were raising the alarm even at that time. The Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to him for the so-called peace that he said he brought between Ethiopia and Eritrea after 20 years of no war, no peace status between these two states. But even from the get-go, there was nothing known to the Ethiopian people about this peace accord that he has signed with Isaias Afwerki, Eritrea's dictator, our neighbor in the north.
Sedele, we've spoken about the violence and famine in Tigray, the crushing of dissent in Oromia province, Prime Minister Abiy's own home. Is this election today likely to make the unrest better or worse in Ethiopia?
Unless the prime minister reverses course and gets into a genuine political settlement, if he goes as he's calculating now, which is that I have the legitimacy, I have the state power, and then I can do whatever I want. The others are spectators. There is no outlook as we go by for the parties that it alienates, in which these parties can be somehow incorporated into the political process. So these parties will remain to be marginalized. So that is going to, of course, lead to resentment and anger.
You are speaking with us today from Germany. I'm just wondering how safe you would feel criticizing the government making these analyses in Ethiopia today.
Yes, I was in and out, of course. I'm traveling back. My team are there, and I have no plan of not going back to my own country. But there is something that has changed with Abiy Ahmed, and which is that he has outsourced violence against his critics. Previously, when we were criticizing the regime, the confrontation was with the state, the police, or whatever it is that controls the state's apparatus. Abiy Ahmed is doing things a little bit differently in a way that he has privatized that repression to individuals, private individuals. So these people attack you through the cyberspace. They try to threaten your family members. They try to threaten your work. They try to just, you know, dress you down in every way possible they can. So that keeps me awake. I'll be lying to you if I say I'm not concerned about that. That worries me, honestly speaking. But again, I take chances.
Journalist Sedele Lema is the founder of the Addis Standard, a monthly magazine based in Ethiopia. She's been speaking with us from Germany. Thank you very much, Sedele, for your thoughts.
Thanks for having me.
In Russia, COVID infections are on the rise again. This marks the country's third surge of coronavirus. Over the weekend, authorities in Moscow reported the highest number of new infections yet. Irina Yakutenko joins me to talk about the latest. Irina is a Russian science writer based in Berlin and the author of The Virus That Broke the Planet. Irina, how do you explain this latest wave of infections in Russia, and in Moscow in particular?
So that's not a big surprise that we have a third wave now. So almost no one wore masks for several months, and all the cinemas were open, restaurants, cafes, bars, schools. And now we have this Delta strain, this coincidence, this transmissible strain, and a lot of people with no immunity. We have only 10% of people who were vaccinated. And so now we have this third wave.
What about the status of vaccinations in Russia? What vaccines are available? How effective are they? And how many people have gotten them?
There are three vaccines that are available in Russia, Sputnik V or V, Epivac Corona that was developed in Novosibirsk, and Covivac that was developed in Chumakov Center, the center that was previously developed this polio vaccine.
So all three are Russian-made vaccines?
Yes, at the moment there are three vaccines. However, we have data about efficacy only for one of them, for Sputnik, and maybe Sputnik will be approved in European Union. Two other vaccines, there are almost no data about them. So formally, we have three vaccines in Russia, but data that can be more or less regarded as reliable, we have only for Sputnik.
So Sputnik V is effective and available. Are people getting Sputnik V?
No, the total amount of people who were vaccinated is about 10%.
Across all of Russia is 10%?
Yes, totally in Russia. And I think that it's bigger in big cities and smaller in towns and outskirts of Russia. And it is available since December. And so that's like total failure of this vaccine campaign in Russia, because more than half a year, everyone can get their shot. And they didn't do that.
Irina, that's pretty stunning. Just 10% of Russia is vaccinated. Why is that?
The first reason that people that don't trust officials, don't trust that vaccine is good. And starting from the very first days of the pandemic, there was official propaganda that COVID is not dangerous. There is like hysteria in Western countries, so you shouldn't be worried about that. The people, they didn't regard COVID as a serious problem. So, of course, they didn't motivate them to get this shot. The second reason is that when we see research about vaccine hesitancy, Russia is always one of the first places. Of course, that's not the real reason. There is like an emotional reaction. They don't want to be vaccinated because they didn't assess the risks properly. So from the one hand, they don't think COVID is dangerous. And from the other hand, a lot of people, they think vaccines are dangerous because this is a new vaccine and no one knows what's the consequences. And there was a lot of propaganda on Russian TV about Moderna and Pfizer, about AstraZeneca. So a lot of TV shows where they discussed that it is very dangerous. A lot of people have died because of these side effects. People think that maybe Sputnik also can have these side effects. So there's, a lot of reasons.
A lot of mixed messages, too, leading to this vaccine hesitancy in Russia. You mentioned the mistrust in officials, mistrust in the Kremlin. Why is that? Is that an old history that explains that, or is it more recent mistrust in the Kremlin?
I think that's a long tradition in Russia not to trust the officials. It's starting in Soviet Union, and now it's going on through modern Russian history as well.
I also see the Kremlin, of course, it's in a position to do this, to mandate vaccines, and it's done so for workers in retail, in education, and some other service sectors. What motivated that action, and what has been the response to that?
I think partly it will work. So for some people who are not that sure that they don't want to be vaccinated, they have doubts, they can go and get their shot. They don't want any problems. But there is a big, big market of these false documents about vaccination, vaccine certificates. So you can now buy it in internet. And I think that a lot of people who are strictly against vaccination, they will do this. They will buy these papers that they were vaccinated, but in reality, they won't get their shot.
That is troubling news on COVID from Russia. Irina Yakutenko is a Russian science writer based in Berlin, speaking with us about the latest coronavirus surge in Russia. Thank you very much, Irina.
Yeah, thank you.
Around the world, officials have tried to get people vaccinated with all sorts of incentives. In Moscow, the mayor is giving away cars, apparently not helping. New Jersey is handing out whiskey shots. In Tel Aviv, it's free pizza. Thailand is just getting started with its vaccination campaign. Just 3% of people there have the jab. The World's Patrick Wynn tells us about one gimmick in Thailand to get people there to roll up their sleeves.
That is a big grunting cow, weighing nearly 1 ton. And up in Thailand's northern farming country, it's a valuable beast. Now anyone who gets vaccinated in Madjam, a Thai district about the size of Rhode Island, has a chance to win a free cow. For weeks, officials there have been going out to drum up excitement for this giveaway. Just sign up for the vaccine and you're in the running, an official tells a crowd. That's from a clip posted to social media. It's basically a raffle. One cow given away every week for the rest of the year. The chief of the district has also gone online to make the pitch. Cows are easy to raise, easy to sell, says Chief Bunle Tamtara Nurak. You need money quick, he says. Boom, sell a cow. Any slaughterhouse will give you $300. Don't picture black and white milk cows. In Thailand, cows are usually brown and humpbacked, and not often milked, but useful in other ways. Their manure is great fertilizer for rice fields. As for easy to raise, well, they do come when you call them. That is a Thai farmer summoning her cow from across a field. Now, Thailand has a long way to go with its national vaccine rollout. In the cities, demand is greater than supply. People are lining up. But some worry that in the countryside, people will be less adamant about getting jabbed. And Thailand needs everyone to get vaccinated, from the mountains to the sea, if the country wants to reach herd immunity. Only then can the tourist come back. And that's vital for repairing the economy, which is in shambles. Like most countries, Thailand has had a tough year so far. But Bun Le, the district chief up north, says the free cow giveaway could help make things a little better. He says, we just want to see everyone happy and vaccinated. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen. I love the colorful clothes you wear and the way the sunlight plays upon her hair.
It is the first full day of summer, but that's not why you're hearing Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys. We're focusing today on Van Dyke Parks, one of the band's closest collaborators on that track and many others. In the 60s and 70s, Parks was a standout innovator in the L.A. music scene as a producer, arranger, and songwriter. From a young age, he was also deeply interested in music from other parts of the world and its impact on American music. That curiosity is still very much alive with Van Dyke Parks, whose latest collaboration is with Mexican musician Veronica Valerio.
Desorden de las estrellas, hoy que salí a mirar, buscándome estoy en ellas, no me he podido encontrar.
From Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula, singer-songwriter and harpist Veronica Valerio is with me. Great to meet you, Veronica.
Hello, Marco.
And in Los Angeles, musician and producer Van Dyke Parks. Hello to you.
Thank you, Marco.
So, Veronica, what did you think when this legendary American producer you'd never met wanted to work with you?
I told Van Dyke, my knees are shaking. Is it you? Is it you? And he's like, come on, come on. I was very, very excited.
You knew about Van Dyke Parks and his career and what he's done.
Absolutely. I'm just remembering the moment when he called me back, because I sent him a message. And after he wrote me back, next thing he did was calling me on the phone. That's what I was like, what? Is this you? For real?
Van Dyke Parks, how did you first come across Veronica's music?
Veronica asked me if I was able to help her get a record. And I admitted immediately that at the age of 78, I'm totally passé. And that I was just useless. But I thought, on the other hand, what is it that you do? And I asked her then to send me some music. And no kidding, it floored me. It floored me because it brought back something very familiar to me, in spite of the fact that I'm totally Anglo in my origins and my gravitation. But the thing is, it was the harp that got me. And Veronica plays harp and is part of a tradition that is in her family, or her grandfather, etc., with this, with the affection for the harp. And so Veronica's music, the language, the irregularity of the meter, it was the greatest opportunity I've had folklorically in music in my life. I'm very fascinated by it.
Those are impressive words.
Del cerro hacia los bajíos se juntaron las corrientes. Entre lluvias y crecientes, entre montañas y llanos.
Veronica, when did you start playing the harp in this style of music, Son Jarocho? I mean, it's very traditional, isn't it?
Yeah, I was 13 when I met my biological dad, who happens to be a harp player. I knew about music because I was surrounded by singer-songwriters, but I had a cultural shock when I met my dad, and the only thing that
could us get through any kind of conversation, which happens to be music, no words conversation. We never got into that. But on music, we did.
So the other thing that's kind of fascinating about this project, Veronica, you and Van Dyke Parks have actually never met in person. The pandemic interrupted the in-person collaboration. It doesn't seem to have affected the captivating quality of this music, though. But what has that process been like for you?
I've been, this is a word in Spanish, pedaleando myself, like biking alone, you know? And for a few times, there is people who resonate with me, and all of a sudden, I have to go because I moved to a different city or I had changed the country. I mean, I had to move from the country or whatever. But with Van Dyke, I never felt like, he's here and he's going to leave or I am going to leave. It gave me some kind of freedom. It's, I don't know, it's his personality. It's such a, like, ¿cómo se dice? Honest, authentic, that it never got me to feel, oh, he's leaving, I am leaving, or nothing. It was just a smooth calm. It's like, is this somebody that I'm supposed to know? He's just a gentleman.
So Van Dyke Parks, situate this project and Veronica's voice against the backdrop of like all your other work, from the Beach Boys' Smile, your own American songscapes, pairing American idioms with sounds from other parts of the world, like Latin or West Indian music. In your mental musical map that has been your long career, where does this album Only in America fit in?
Well, you'll notice the album title is Only in America. And that is sin fronteras. It's without these borders, these impositions. This is an invitation to multiculturalism. I don't speak Spanish, but I speak music, and that's why I responded to Veronica. And always, whether it was the Beach Boys, the Steel Bands, Arlo Guthrie, Everly Brothers, whatever it was, every aspect of this record took me somewhere out of the box. This was a poetic force of Veracruz, and I was all of a sudden very fortunate to have crossed the aisle.
Yo nací con la luna de plata. Y nací con alma de pirata. He nacido rumbera y jarocha, trovadora de veras.
Veronica, for you as a Mexican singer, why was it important to be part of a project called Only in America? I mean, what does the U.S. mean to you?
It means family. To me, this album reunites like all the differences, but come in a togetherness, if it is that possible.
Mm.
Like all those differentiations, but with no bridges or borders or anything. It's just one. Big, but one.
Veracruz, son tus noches, diluvio de estrellas, palmera y mujer.
When will you actually meet each other? Like, will it be the first live show?
I don't know. I've been wondering if to bring this bottle of mezcal to Van Dyke's door before my visa expires. I don't know. We're doing our part. The rest is up to the universe.
Well, I'm counting on the universe to do the right thing. Veronica Valerio and Van Dyke Parks. The album is Van Dyke Parks Orchestrates Veronica Valerio, Only in America. Thank you both for speaking with us.
You're most kind.
Thank you.
Va volando sin escalas, un pájaro en el ciprés. Un pájaro en el ciprés.
Va volando sin escalas.
Y todos piensan que es un arco iris con alas. Va volando sin escalas.
Un pájaro en el ciprés.
And that is our show on this Monday, the first full day of summer. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Vuela, vuela, vuela. Vuela sin tardanza. Mientras que la vida dure, lugar tiene la esperanza.
The World is supported by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. PRI 2020 donors, including the Rose Family Fund, investing in informed risk-taking. by the Gruber Family Foundation, investing in global reporting and perspectives, and by the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
PRX. From PRX.